Mark and Reprisal by Elizabeth Moon. Narrated by Cynthia Holloway. Copyright 2004 by Elizabeth Moon. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Elizabeth Moon, care of Jabberwocky Literary Agency, and was produced in the year 2008 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Chapter 1. Kalaravada looked at the mass of paperwork from Belinta's Economic Development Bureau and sighed. The real life of a trade ship captain. Paperwork and more paperwork. Negotiation with shippers, customers, customs officials. The life she hadn't wanted when she chose to enter the Slaughter Key Space Force Academy. And the life she had fallen back into when she was expelled. Boring. Mundane. Not that her recent experiences in Sabine had been boring or mundane. Terrifying was more like it. And no one would want another trip like that. Except that she did. She remembered very clearly the rush of excitement, the soaring glee of the fight itself, the guilty delight when she killed Pison and Christofsen. So either she wasn't sane or nothing. She thought of the diamonds tucked into her underwear drawer. Not enough to restore her old tub of a ship completely, but enough to take her to somewhere else, somewhere where she could make the kind of life she really wanted. Perhaps the mercenaries would accept her violent tendencies. They offered a chance. Perhaps someone else. It would annoy her family, but not as much as the truth would hurt them. No, she had to finish one job at least. Crew depended on her. This ship belonged to her family as well, and she could not possibly earn enough to buy it away by the next stop, or the next. She sighed again, signed another sheet, and stared at the next. All right, then. Take this old tub to Lenora. Deliver that cargo, then to Lastway. If she couldn't finance a refit by then, return to the original plan and go home by commercial passenger ship. If she made enough profit, enough to do the refit, she could get that done and bring the ship back to Slaughter Key and then resign. Or, she stared into a distance far beyond her cabin bulkhead, she could send the ship back with someone else. Quincy, for instance, knew enough to run the ship herself. In the long run, her family would be better off without her. If her father knew how she'd felt when she killed. No. She had had those nightmares, trying to explain to that gentle man, hoping for his understanding, but seeing the horror in his face. Better the smothering, overprotective love that had annoyed her in their last conversation than that horror, that disgust, that rejection. If she went home, he would sense something. He would try to probe, try to get her to confide in him, and eventually he would wear her down. It would be worse than anything else that had happened to have her father sorry she was ever born. She should just go away. Years later, maybe, she might be able to explain it to him, and he might be able to accept it. Years might put a safe skin on the raw truth of what she was. She worked her way through the rest of the forms, then decided to take them to the local postal drop herself. Belinta Station had few amenities, but a walk would be refreshing in itself. Quincy, I'm going to drop the paperwork off, she said into the ship's intercom. Find anything to load? Or do you want us to start transferring what we have left in storage? I haven't found anything yet, Kai said. I may have to go downside for that. Go on and load. See if you can get some of the station dock workers to help with that. Usual rates and all. She glanced at herself in the mirror and decided she was presentable enough. She needed a new uniform. The one she had left after Sabine no longer had the crisp, perfect tailoring her mother had paid for. But only if she was staying with Vada. If she joined a mercenary company, she would wear its uniform. If she stayed independent, she'd have to find one of her own design. But to drop off forms to be transmitted to a bureaucracy, gray tunic and slacks should be sufficient. She clipped on the Belinta Station access pass. Outside the ship, Belinta Station hardly bustled with activity. Only three ships were in dock, and the other two were in-system haulers servicing Belinta's meager satellite mining operations. On their own dockside, Quincy was talking to a burly man in the ubiquitous green tunic of Belinta dockworkers. Bia, beside her, held a compad ready to record employee data if Quincy's negotiations were successful. Kai walked briskly past two men chatting on a bench, a woman standing by a lift entrance, barely restraining a bouncing toddler. The faded ads for Belinta's few and unenticing tourist resorts, and turned left into the wide main corridor. Here were the currency exchanges, banks, communication services, local and Ansible, Belinta Port Authority, the hiring hall, and, finally, the postal service. Mid-shift, few others were in sight. Someone with a briefcase just going into Belinta's savings and loan. Two women chatting as they emerged from All Systems Exchange. Beyond were rows of blanketed openings to spaces that would someday, if Belinta proved prosperous, house more services, more stores, more people. No traffic at all moved down there. Kai turned into the postal services entrance and walked up to the counter where a display read, "Now serving number 682. The only clerk in sight did not look up, but said, "Take a number." Typical Belintan courtesy, Kai thought, and looked around for the number generator. By the entrance, she pulled the tab. The counter display changed to, "Now serving 683, and the clerk said, "Number 683, in an annoyed tone, as if she'd kept him waiting. "This is all for the Economic Development Bureau," Kai said. "To whose attention?" asked the clerk. "It doesn't matter, just the EDB. "It has to be directed to an individual," the clerk said. "You can't send mail to the whole bureau." "It says on the form," Kai said, pointing to the block under "Return to." "No name, just the bureau." "It has to have a name," the clerk said. "It's the rules. All mail to government agencies must be directed to an individual." Kai was tempted to make up a name. Instead, she said, "Do you have a directory?" "Customers are not allowed to use our confidential directories or communication devices," the clerk intoned. "This is a security issue. Customers are advised to identify the correct recipient prior to arriving in the Postal Service office. Next, please." Kai glanced behind her. No one stood in line. "It wouldn't take a moment to look it up." "Next, please." The clerk still wasn't looking at her. Kai wanted to reach across the counter and wring his skinny neck. But that was the impulse of a moment. This was part of being a trade ship captain. This was the kind of senseless, ridiculous, annoying nonsense she could expect. "Fine," she said instead. "I'll deliver it myself." After all, she had to go downside anyway, to find out if there was any cargo worth carrying from this wretched planet. "Glad to be of service. Have a nice day," the clerk said all in one breath. Kai went back the way she'd come, past the corridor that led to the docking area, past Good Time Eats and Jerry's Real Food and Quick Snack, where the two women she'd seen earlier were head-to-head over a small table, to the ticket office for the shuttle service. She could not remember just when the daily service left.
2.5 hours, the clerk said. "Be at the boarding area 1/2 hour before departure."
That gave time to go back to her ship and change. She turned to go, but a screech from the PA system stopped her. "What's that?"
"I don't know," the clerk said. "Stay where you are," a bone-shaking voice said. All personnel, stay where you are. Emergency crews 1 and 2 to dockside on the double. All personnel.
My ship, Kai said. I have to get back.
But the ticket office entrance was closed, the metal grate locking with a final chung even as she moved toward it.
You heard him, the clerk said. We're all supposed to stay put.
Well, I can't, Kai said. Open that thing.
Can't, the clerk said. It's automatic, like section seals. Station security controls it. Unless you've got the override code, like one of the emergency crews.
The PA announcement had stopped. 15 minutes later, the grate slid back into its slot, squeaking a little.
Return to normal activity, the PA said. All personnel, return to normal activity.
Still no announcement of what had prompted the lockdown. Kai hurried back to the docking area. She saw nothing unusual except a station security officer standing near Gary Tobias's open hold bay talking to Quincy.
What was that about? She asked, coming up to them.
Nothing to concern you, madam, said the officer. Please stand away.
It's the captain, Quincy said. Just as Kai said,
it's my ship. It concerns me.
Oh, the man looked confused.
You're not in uniform.
It needs cleaning, Kai said. Here's my tag.
She held it out and he scanned it.
What happened?
We believe an attempt was made to rob your ship, the man said. Individuals known to us of dubious character were hired to move cargo, and this individual, he nodded at Quincy, noticed something untoward with one of the containers and challenged the individual transporting it, suspecting that a substitution had been made. Two individuals ran away. This individual called the alarm.
Theft by casual dockside labor was a constant threat, Kai knew.
Did you catch them? They have not been apprehended yet, the officer said. They made it to the unoccupied spaces. We are confiscating this container, which they tried to put aboard, and we are searching for the legitimate container your crew member reports missing.
I'm sure you'll take care of things, Kai said.
Will we find you here? The man asked.
No, Kai said. I must go downside to deliver reports to your government. My shuttle leaves...
She checked the time.
Sorry, I must hurry. Quincy will serve as my agent for the duration of my visit down. All right, Quincy?
The old woman nodded. I can do that. Will you be buying cargo?
Quite possibly. I expect to be downside a few days. I'll keep in touch.
Kai hurried into the ship. She put on her remaining uniform with the formal captain's cape and made 2 quick calls to arrange lodging at the captain's guild and an escort to meet her at the downside shuttle terminal. She hesitated, then put several of the diamonds in her pocket. She didn't expect anything to cut off her access to Vada resources, but just in case, it couldn't hurt to have hard currency. She made her shuttle connection with a few minutes to spare, and rode downside with a mixed lot of Belinta station workers going home for the weekend break. She cataloged them automatically. Clerical, clerical, equipment operator, service worker, and wondered why she bothered. It was the same mix she could find anywhere across the galaxy. No duller here than elsewhere. She spotted her escort at the passenger exit, and they exchanged the passwords and ID checks, another familiar routine. They rode into the city, past fields stripped with a more vivid green than Belintons ever wore. She recognized the machine working its way across one of the fields as one she'd delivered from Sabine, and felt a surge of satisfaction. If she could learn to appreciate the good done by the cargo she transported, if she could see things from that angle, maybe. Gerard Avendetta Vada watched as his pilot loaded his small case in the light plane. They would be back in the city by nightfall. He and Stavros would have a working dinner,
and tomorrow he would tackle the delicate political tangle still left by his daughter's abrupt departure from the academy. Now that she was out of danger, now that he had seen her face, had spoken to her, his attention had returned to the reasons behind the obvious reasons. Why had a Misnari complained about religious discrimination in the academy? Misnari were a difficult sect, to be sure, but they'd served in the Slaughter Key Space Force for the past 30 years or so without any problems he knew of. And why had Kai been chosen as the vehicle? Her habit of helping lame dogs made her gullible, of course, and yet it did not quite satisfy him. She was a naturally generous person, yes, but he had noticed a streak of hardness in her that boded well for her survival in the cutthroat world of interstellar shipping. When she came back, it might be time to tell her a few things not in the basic Vada database her implant contained. The Misnari. Were they part of the resurgence of anti-Humod feeling some of the Vada captains had reported? They were certainly foundational purists who refused even the most common enhancements and modifications, such as cranial implants. But he hadn't heard they bothered with off-planet politics. Besides, Kai had little exposure to Humods. She could hardly be a target for anti-Humod bias. Then there was interstellar communications. Vada had supported ISC all along, and he fully appreciated what ISC had done for Kai at Sabine, but he wondered if its judgment matched its power. He tried to say something about that to Lou Parmina, the last time Lou visited, but Lou had shrugged off his concerns. "We pay our researchers enough to keep them quiet," he'd said. "No muzzling the ox that treads the grain, you know." Still, there were other sources of wealth in the galaxy, some who would be willing to pay almost any price for the secrets of ISC labs. Some already funding research, he was sure, trying to duplicate the secrets of ISC's technology or trying to advance it. The attack on the Ansible platforms at Sabine had been crude, but to Gerard's mind, clearly a test. How strong was ISC, and how fast could it respond? The pirates, too. The information from Sabine was disturbing. An alliance of pirates? Of their agents in legitimate firms? And how did that work? Vada had thousands of employees on dozens of ships, more dozens of support offices. Was one of them a traitor, feeding information to pirates? So far, the pirates had concentrated on smaller shippers, driving several out of business, according to the Captain's Guild figures, if they were accurate. The largest shippers hadn't been hit. But that wouldn't last, he was sure. They would run out of easy targets and move on to take other prey. The great merchant companies, Vada among them, had never persuaded the planetary governments that their trade served to combine and create a true interstellar space force capable of policing the spaceways. ISC had the resources, but refused to use them for anything but maintaining its own assets. Gerard pinged his implant to remind him to call Gracie Lane when he got to the city. Vada's spy service, Stavros called her, though her title on the books was special assistant to the chairman. "Expecting company?" the pilot asked suddenly. "What?" Gerard turned. His pilot was staring into the limpid afternoon sky. "My implant says the airfield scans have picked up two unidentified aircraft coming in from the east." "From the Great Ocean? That made no sense. The regular inter-island passenger plane for the mainland had already been and gone, and anyway, they didn't overfly this end of the island. East of Coralay, the next inhabited island chain was the Merrill Archipelago, and its air traffic avoided the 1,500-kilometer gap, flying south to the Rim Reef, then back west along it. Between Merrill and here were only a few uninhabited chunks of rock, recently emerged and sometimes temporarily volcanic peaks.
His implant, not linked to the private airfield's minimal scans, fought its way through the safety lockouts. But by the time he had access to the air scans, he could see the two tiny dots rapidly growing larger and hear their thin whine.
"Gaspard, do you have any idea?" he began. Then his implant squealed a warning relayed from the airfield scans.
Weapons. Those little flying things had weapons.
He whirled, started to run toward the office building beyond the airfield.
"No, sir! Get down!"
Gerard paid no attention, but his pilot, younger and faster, tackled him just short of the grass verge. He hit the ground hard, furious. The snarling whine overhead, much louder now, coming at him. Fear soured his mouth. He covered his head with his hands, realizing how useless that was. His implant threw up visuals of the things, windowless, short-winged, unmanned, just before the flash of light, the noise, the blow of rushing air and debris that rolled him over and over on the tarmac. Then the second flash, the second boom and roar, much fainter. He blinked, rolled to his knees. Gaspard gripped his shoulders. The pilot, already on his feet, was pale as cheese curds. Ahead, the office building was a mass of flames and roiling black smoke. And beyond to the right, where the house, the comfortable home, had stood, a column of flame and smoke.
"Myris," he said.
"San!" He wrenched free of Gaspard and ran to the office first because it was closer. He was aware of Gaspard running beside him, though he could not hear his footsteps through the roaring in his ears and the clamor of the flames. Someone staggered out, ahead of him, and Gerard slowed to look. One of the clerks, white-rimmed eyes staring out of a smoke-blackened face.
"What?"
"Take care of her," Gerard said to his pilot. "Call." But emergency services for this end of the island were housed in the other end of the building. If they had survived, they'd already be at work.
"Call back to the town. Medical. Call the city. Warn Stav."
Two more figures staggered out, one half carrying the other. Gerard moved toward them.
"You have the skull phone," Gaspard yelled to him.
He blinked against the stinging smoke. Yes, he did. Mental fingers fumbling with the shock, he called his brother.
"Jerry," Stavros answered, "what's wrong? Aren't you coming in this afternoon?"
"Evacuate the building," Gerard said.
"What?"
"Someone's just dropped bombs on us here at Coralay," Gerard said. "Some kind of drone-planed thing. Clear headquarters. They'll hit there next."
"I just got an Ansible call about some trouble on Allway," Stavros said. "Connections?"
A burning cinder landed on Gerard's hand. He flicked it off.
"Certainly. Clear the building, damn it."
"I've already hit the alarm, Jerry. They're going. It takes time, you know."
They didn't have time. He knew that, even as he closed on the fiery maelstrom and tried to steel himself to go in and help survivors.
"Put out an all-systems warning. Let our people know."
"Right, on it. Are you all right?"
"I'm alive. I've got to get in there and see if San..."
"Jerry, don't! Let the rescue squad..."
"It's gone,"
Gerard said, as the afternoon breeze pushed the column of smoke to one side. He could see that the bomb had hit on that end of the office building.
"Myris?
The house was hit. I don't know. She was going out to swim after lunch. I pray she did."
If even the pool would be enough protection, and that still meant the household staff cleaning up after lunch. He squeezed his eyes shut a moment and said a short, fervent prayer.
"Stav, I heard what you said. They're leaving. You leave too. Get in the bunker."
"I will,"
Starborough said. When I'm through, I'm sending out the all systems warning now. All right. I'm leaving it to a volunteer. I'm moving.
It was too hot. The flames burning his face meters from the fire itself. He had just remembered the fuel storage tanks for the emergency vehicles when the next explosion threw him off his feet, onto something sharp and hard, and the next three tossed more of the building his way, debris as effective as any other form of shrapnel. He was just waking up when Gaspard and old George dug him out of the pile. His left side hurt with every breath. A rib, he suspected, or two. He coughed, and the pain stabbed deep. Smoke still billowed from the wreckage, but most of the flames had blown out. Stubs of walls, spikes of unidentifiable framing members. With the survivors, pitifully few, he stared at the ruin. Somewhere in there was San, his only son on planet. Surely dead. He turned away, unwilling to look anymore. Gaspard stayed with him as he staggered toward the house. Here nothing was left but a hole in the ground. The gardens were covered with debris. A single flowering spray of Luchus orchids curled up from beneath a window frame, still unwilted. They made their way around to the back, where parts of the roof had breached the garden wall. A mat of debris floated on the water of the big pool. Shards of wood, sheets of paper, bits of cloth, fronds of jobla still pink with bloom, and wide leaves of the haricond like rafts, each with its own burden of grit and unidentifiable pieces. Some sank as he watched, as the wind ruffled the surface. He was on his knees at the edge of the pool, mouth stuffed with fear and anguish, unable to call her name, unable to see. Someone was crying. Someone was saying her name. Someone's hands were wet, the water stinging the burns. Someone was pulling at her shoulder, struggling to get her face out of the water, ignoring the red streaks turning pink in the dirty water. And then he was lying back against someone, someone talking to him, and he could see her lying in the sun as it dimmed and brightened with the whirls of smoke blowing past. Water pooled under her, water stained red, and she did not turn her head to him, did not cry out, did not ask what happened. Someone put a flask to his lips. He smelled the sharp edge of whiskey he didn't want, but he sipped because his throat was dry, and then nearly choked because it was raw, pain almost as sharp as that in his heart. He smelled clean earth and onions, and saw that the hands of the person he lay against were crusted with earth and a shred of green. A gardener. His mind seemed to float, slowly noticing, slowly combining what it noticed. Then it all came together. Attacks, explosion, the house and his wife gone, the office and his son gone. He had warned Stavros. He had to. He tried to sit up, and his ribs stabbed him again. The hands behind him helped, lifted. They're dead. He heard himself say. His ears still rang. His voice sounded tinny. They're all. Who's alive? Gaspard had the list. Solar, Tina, Vindy from the clerk section, Bonas, who had been in the toilets on the end not directly hit, Gaspard, old George, all three gardeners, little Rick, who had been sweeping the front porch and drive, and been blown into the ornamental grove of palms and joblas that the drive circled. Everyone was watching the sky. He had to do something, start sorting things out. Water, he heard old George say. Gotta get some water first. I'll check the tanks, said the gardener who'd been supporting him. If you can stand, sir. He could stand. He had to stand. He still had people depending on him.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?